And they said to me, you know, could you send me a rate card? And I literally remember Googling as she was on the phone, like, what is a rate card? Because I don't have a press department or marketing.
You are the marketing
department. I am the marketing department.
Has it been your dream to become an engineer, to switch from the job that you're working right now, be taken seriously, get a full-time salary, and be coding? Then go to hackreactor.com, the trusted resource to become a credible engineer. That's hackreactor.com/scholarships if you want to check out more on how to become an engineer at no cost at all. Remember to enter in the code Women in Tech. The Women in Tech podcast is an independent production funded by you, the community. To support Women in Tech, if you believe in the vision as much as we do, please consider going to patreon.com/womenintech. That's patreon.com/womenintech to make a small contribution to keep this podcast going. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Women in Tech podcast. You guys are in for a treat right now. First of all, I'm with one of my favorite people in the world. I can't even contain myself. I'm so giddy to be sitting with Theodora here in London, England. I'm literally only in London to see her and to see my friend Harry, who has the podcast 20 Minute VC, which is incredible. So if you haven't heard of that podcast, definitely go check out that podcast too to figure out all about the venture capital world. Theodora is magical. She's inspiring. She had a very successful blog / company / everything that she's going to get into that she just had acquired. She mentors startups and she's just like, I'm madly in love with her. I'm just going to tell you guys right now. So this is going to be a very obscure interview because I just think the world of her and she's incredibly inspiring and driven. And we met each other 3 years ago and I'm really grateful to be here. I think how I'd like to start is where are we and what were you doing tonight?
So tonight we're at a place in London called the Institute of Directors, which I was a member of because it has a very special entrepreneurs group of 99 people under 40 who launched their own startup. So this is an incredibly beautiful old building for normally massive companies like, you know, Shell or some of the oldest companies in the UK. And I'm definitely one of their younger members. So tonight was actually looking at helping refugees. And we had an interesting event with a speaker from Google who was talking about the power of technology to help people to get jobs living in refugee camps. So quite an unusual event for me tonight.
You had Google and you had IKEA, right?
Yeah, we did. We had actually a British government minister talking about the UK policy from the government. And then we had the head of one of the biggest NGOs, International Rescue Committee. And we had the IKEA Foundation and also the head of Europe and the Middle East for Google.
I mean, it's insane. So we met approximately 3 years ago at an organization called Astia, something that I went through. It's an organization that empowers female founders who have raised money to be the strongest leaders that they could possibly be. When I went through Astia, I flew to San Francisco once a week. I was living in Los Angeles and I was driven and hustling to be the best business person I could possibly be. And then so years later, when I was in London doing my last backpacking trip, I met with Astia London, and that is where I met Theodora. Well, you were there just kind of like snooping about, right?
Yeah, well, I was a couple of years into my startup. I didn't have any investors or any co-founders. And someone contacted me about Astia and said, you know, you're a female startup director, you should come along. So it was really just to find out a bit more about kind of the scene. And I think when you launch your own startup and you're working at home, you know, on your MacBook at the kitchen sink, you kind of don't really know about this whole scene that's out there. And I think you guys in the States have, you know, a huge scene, particularly in California. So it's really exciting for me to see kind of East London and what's been happening around Tech City and kind of Shoreditch and to kind of break into that community.
100%. And one thing, if I'm remembering this correctly, is that I was in awe by your progress and success and what you were working on, which you'll get into. And you didn't really think that made you a tech person, or you kind of, yeah, if I remember correctly, you hadn't wrapped your head around how outstanding that was.
Well, I think,
am I remembering right?
Yeah, no, you are. Cause I remember all these people were talking about coding and I'm not a coder. I mean, I can't write C++ or lines of anything. But I suppose I did start two blogs, which came pretty successful. So I suppose I did teach myself kind of WordPress, and I should point out that I have no IT background whatsoever. I mean, I studied art history at university and I literally kind of used to watch Google videos on YouTube of like how to build a blog, and then just basically did it myself. So I was kind of no background in tech at all.
So let's get into it. I think I actually forgot the official intro because I'm so excited that I'm just anywhere physically around you right now. So let's start officially go ahead and introduce yourself. And you guys, she recently, her company was acquired, but she's going to talk about that company and then what she's doing today. So go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us about your role with your blogs and your role today.
Yeah. So it was all completely accidental that I ended up starting a startup. So I was at university.
Wait, your name first.
My name is Theodora.
Theodora Clark.
Yes. And my blog is called Russian Art and Culture, which sounds super niche and specific because it was. I was at college writing my PhD thesis on Russian art. So artists sort of, you know, being persecuted in the Soviet Union. And, you know, I'd gone from working in Wall Street and banking to then coming back to the UK and kind of sitting in your ivory tower. And they say, you know, go write your book, come back in 4 years. And it gets quite lonely when you're kind of writing your thesis. So I organized a conference and loads of delegates came. And we all came from universities around the world. So, you know, Australia or from Harvard or from Cambridge, Moscow. And I just thought, I can't possibly organize one event and get all these people in the same room at the same time. And that's when I had the idea for starting an art blog. So really, it was just really humble origins. It was how to bring together kind of academics, curators, professors, students who were researching the same area as me. So I literally never thought when I sat on Google and watched a video on how to literally write the most basic WordPress blog, that 5 years later it would have been bought by one of the biggest art dealers in Europe. And in fact, my website was voted top 10 arts website in the UK.
It's amazing. Now, are you able to share what the acquisition amount was?
I'm afraid I'm not, because I did sign an NDA.
Yeah.
But it's been a riveting process. And actually, the person who acquired my company was my very first client. So the first person who believed in my concept, who wrote me a check. And I had the blog. So I had a community of about 50,000 people, which I thought was quite a lot for a student sort of website on a very niche topic.
100%.
And what came about is, you know, I said I want to create a magazine and I want to launch an art fair and I need some startup capital to do that. And I literally just had kind of an idea on the back of an envelope and they wrote me a check. And I think it was that first belief in the concept that 5 years later, they've actually been the buyer.
I mean, congratulations. There's so many exciting things that I'd love for us to share with everyone listening. One is, in the startup world, they're always like, okay, I have this idea, but how do I get anybody to know that I exist? How in the world did you get your first 1,000 visitors?
That is a great question. So when I started the blog, I never thought it would turn into a company. It was because I built a community that it happened. So the original blog, I literally sat down on a Sunday and I think I wrote a review of a major exhibition in London at one of the big art shows. And then I kind of posted a few academic grants and papers. And then I sent out a mailing list newsletter to all the people who'd attended my conference. So the first like 100 people were the actual attendees. And then I think what really made it go viral was basically social media. So I set up Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I think Twitter was what really made us go huge, because suddenly all these people started reading the website in Australia and in Israel and in Mexico and all these countries. Like, I never even thought of accessing the demographic of audience. So that was kind of a massive surprise. And I never expected it to become bigger than a few hundred people.
One thing that you mentioned is that you created a conference. I mean, that in itself needs its own marketing. So how did you put together the conference? I mean, I really want, you know, everyone listening to be able to walk away being like, oh yeah, okay, that's what I do.
Mm-hmm. So literally what I did was I sat down and for about 2 weeks, I just basically stalked every single professor and museum director and curator in my field. So I made a massive Excel spreadsheet and I just Googled every single person who'd ever spoken about Russia, regardless of institution or which company they worked for. And then I literally looked up each individual website, like the Harvard website, found their email. And then if I didn't know what their email was, I'd look up, say, the press person for Harvard, and then I'd work out what the email was based on like firstname.lastname@harvard.edu. So I didn't have any database at all when I started, apart from pretty much my one professor and about 10 other students on my campus. So literally just a case of like, get out there, research, find stuff online.
And I really want you guys to absorb that. There's no like secret pill that overnight you can just be huge and have all the success. It takes really hard work. I mean, one thing that happened like just a few days ago is I produced a Women in Tech celebratory event in Dublin, and I don't know anyone in Dublin, and I'm not from Dublin, and it was a huge success with people spilling out the door, and I worked my ass off.
Yeah.
You know, and I did the exact same thing with a spreadsheet and looking people up and finding out who the influencers are and finding out who like is really passionate about the women in tech community. And I made sure that the intention and purpose of the event was very clear to everyone. And I made sure to deliver upon that. So when they left the event, they felt it was completely worth their time.
Yeah.
So there's no magic pill, but doing an event is a great way to market a company.
Definitely. So I did the conference first, and I made sure I had a really like famous academic who was kind of well known in that space. And then your point about being passionate, you need to make sure you identify the people who are interested. So you could send out a mail shot to 5,000 email addresses, but if they're not interested in the topic, they're not going to come.
Mm-hmm.
So it's better to find the top 50 people and then engage with them. And then those are the people you need in the room who are going to become your ambassadors.
And you know, one thing I did this past time that I hadn't done before, because I'm really keen on never being spammy and never even being remotely close to that. But because I seriously knew no one, I asked everybody who had RSVP'd to tweet out that they're excited to join the event.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe it totally worked. And then people were like retweeting it, and it became kind of this viral storm. Yeah.
Actually, you've just reminded me of something about a second event. So when I decided to launch as a company, I went about having a big opening in quite an unusual way. So I had the website and I knew I had sort of followers, but I didn't know if they were real people who would actually turn up to the actual event. So I remember I sent out an invite saying, you are invited to the launch of my company on this date, 6 months ahead when I had no venue, no sponsor and no guest list and no speaker. And I remember my parents and friends thought I was completely crazy. But I thought if I've sent it out, then I have committed and it's definitely going to happen.
Yeah.
So now I have to kind of be accountable because I've said it out loud. And then how I went about doing it was basically identifying the really famous speaker. And the way I did that was to approach them, offering them something rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
So I found a very famous author in the UK called Anthony Beaver. So he's very well known. He's getting kind of all the bestseller lists on Russia. And I basically approached him and asked to interview him for the blog. And so I didn't ask him to speak at the event in the email. I just wrote to him saying, you know, would you be one of my kind of major interviews? And he said, yes. And then at the very end of the interview, I said, oh, I'm doing this event and I'd love you to speak.
Right.
So once I had him, I kind of had the hook.
Totally.
And then I was able to then go back to get a venue and I used the Russian embassy.
Totally.
And then I was able to use the venue and the speaker to then pitch for sponsors.
Totally.
So I started with nothing, but I just worked out kind of all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle and who was the key one to kind of hook everybody else.
And baby steps. You also built rapport first before you had an ask.
Exactly.
And, you know, an interview for anybody is always beneficial. People are usually down to do an interview because it helps them in their career or whatever it is. And so baby steps, one step at a time. So let's get back into it. So you have this blog and it reaches, you know, 50,000 plus people. And it is the most notable blog for Russian art. Am I saying it right?
Yes, you are.
And something I know nothing about. I know like five words in Russian. and then what kind of company acquires a blog like that? Why would that be of interest to anyone to go? What are they looking to achieve out of acquiring your company?
Yeah.
So I think, when does a blog become a company?
Those are two really good points. So the first thing is that I never expected it to become a company. The reason why we transitioned was because I had one of the big auction houses who contacted me saying they had a Russian sale. And obviously they knew we have this really specific targeted audience, this community of interested readers. And they said to me, you know, could you send me a rate card? And I literally remember Googling as she was on the phone, like, what is a rate card? Because I don't have a press department or marketing. And then I realized it's the kind of, you know, how much people charged advertising in the New York Times or whatever the magazine or paper would be. And I had no idea what to charge them. So I just kind of made up a number. And they just said, yeah, that's fine. Send us an invoice from your marketing department. And of course, I have no department. I have no company.
You are the marketing
department. I am the marketing department. So what I basically realized was that in order to invoice and to have an advert on the blog, I then needed to incorporate. And then I knew nothing about that. So I literally just rang a couple of friends and they said, well, find an accountant, go register. It's, you know, £300-£400 in the UK at Companies House. I was the sole director, sole shareholder. I had no investors. I didn't have any, you know, co-founders. And that's basically how we started. That was our first revenue, was an advert online.
And did you eventually have a team or was it always just you?
Yeah, so the first 6 months was basically just the blog. And obviously I wasn't earning any money from it. I was just doing it purely for fun out of interest on top of my day job. And then there comes a point where suddenly there was getting a lot of emails and a lot of social media and we started to have advertising. And I was getting to the point of like, do I quit my job? And I think it's really difficult for a startup founder. At what point do you leave the safety net of the day job and then you kind of jump into the unknown and you haven't got a full client list and you don't know if you can pay your rent? So I moved home and I said to my mom, like, I'm going to commit 6 months. Let's just see how we get on. And didn't take a salary, didn't pay rent. I just literally moved home for half a year. And then that meant that I was able to hire a member of staff and then to get an office in a shared collective. So it kind of really grew organically. And I think it is really difficult to know when to make that leap. But I think if you are going to commit and you are going to run a business, you do have to make that leap. Because mm-hmm. if you're not going to commit all of your time and resources, then it's not going to get off the ground.
Totally. But you have to, you energy and do the work. Like, yes. I think more than having a good idea is having execution.
Yes. And I always say to people, you know, a lot of people say like, oh, you know, I could have invented the toaster or I could have invented Google. I'm like, yeah, but you didn't.
Right.
There's always, you know, one person who's actually not just had the idea, but they've actually implemented it.
100%. 100%.
And what I found with my website was that there were lots of other people writing about a similar topic, but there was no one who kind of covered all the subjects in my industry and didn't work with all the players. So they were kind of a very small piece of the jigsaw puzzle.
Right, right.
But my blog was the whole of the jigsaw puzzle. And I think that's why we were kind of unique in comparison right. to our competitors.
Which lended itself to having a larger market share because it applies to more people. And when you're already in each area, that means it's already a small market. So you have to figure out a way to optimize the size of that market.
Yeah. And I just realized I didn't answer fully your earlier question about how we kind of turn into a company.
Yeah.
So I literally started with a blog. Which was terrible. It was on Google Blogger. It was one static page and I, you know, built it myself. Then about 6 months later, I built a WordPress site and then paid, you know, a couple hundred pounds for a friend to design it. And then I launched a second website, which was revolved specifically around the art auction house sales in London. So I think the major shift for me was going from purely online, so building a community, to then actually hosting events. And I remember I did a kind of event at a very major bookstore in the UK, which is like Barnes and Noble. And I had kind of three really famous authors who had books out. And we just did that as an experiment. So I think I charged like $20 for a ticket. And we said, you know, we'll be interviewing these authors. They'll be doing their book launch at the bookstore at this time. And I thought, you know, 10 people would turn up. And like 150 people bought tickets and turned up.
That's amazing.
I know. And that's when I was like, oh my God, these are like really committed readers who are not just reading my site, but they actually have now turned into a buying customer. And that's when I realized I had a business proposition.
I mean, that's amazing. Before we move on from that, that one little piece though, when you thought it would only be 10 people, were you worried about being embarrassed with the speakers?
I was, because they were very senior and very well-known academics. And it was also in a very like high profile site. And I think the first time you try anything, you're absolutely terrified. You're going to fall flat on your face. No one's going to come. And then the whole thing is going to be a disaster. But I think if you've done the effort to kind of, you know, research who is the hook, who's going to get people to come. You know, I spent the time probably for a whole week. I just looked up every single listing site in London. I contacted Time Out. I found free
Time
sites.
Out magazine, yeah.
Yeah. So I found there's loads of great websites in London which list free events or, you know, events with prices. And I just literally sat and just emailed and e-shotted every single one of those. So maybe only one in 10, one in 20 replies. But if you, it's a numbers game, right? So if you write to 100 websites saying, please list my event, maybe 10 of them do.
Right.
But then you can kind of increase your numbers.
And one thing you said is once you did one and you see that it works out.
Yeah.
But I have to say, in 2016 alone, I produced 120 events.
Wow. Okay, you're crazy.
No, I'm absolutely crazy. Most of the events are intimate events like dinner parties. I produce approximately 4 to 6 events that are like 75 people to 300 people a session. So a little bit larger, medium size, whatever you want to call it. I freak out at everyone is my point. Like I never, whether it's a super small or like 150 people, 300, which is still relatively small compared to my friends who produce events with like 25,000 people.
Yeah.
But at every single event, including the one this past week, I freak out that no one's going to show up. I never don't freak out.
That is such a good point. And I always say to people, you're only as good as your last event, because that's what people are talking about. And that's what people remember. So I may have done a great event 5 years ago, but if my last three events have been terrible, then the kind of, you know, client list will drop off.
Right.
So I think you have to assume that every event is the first event that that client or that person has been to. And that is how they perceive your brand.
Totally.
So if you don't do a good job, then they're not going to come back or be a repeat customer.
And the reason why I wanted to bring it up is because I think it's really important for people to hear the vulnerability and honesty and what it takes to be a business person. Because I think when they see people like you or people like me or the, you know, other people in the world on stage, they think, oh, they have it all figured out.
Yes.
And one of my personal MOs is to as moronic as it is to show everyone that I have nothing figured out, because I want like one example in the world of just pure honesty that like no one has it figured out. We're just, just drive the car, execute as passionately as you could possibly execute and just hope for the best and give it your all. And then know the universe has your back in the process.
I totally agree with that. And I definitely had no idea when I started out. And even after me running my business for 5 years, there are just so many things I just didn't know about, because, you know, I'm not an accountant or I'm not an expert on computer coding. And I think if you've got the desire to kind of learn and to find out and to teach yourself, then it doesn't really matter what your business is, what the industry is. Like, obviously, my website is a super niche topic, but it's absolutely applicable. All the stuff that I've done, you could set up, you know, a sports website which focuses on something really niche like Taekwondo, and you're going to be the best website in the world on Taekwondo, and there will be an audience for that. So I think kind of my story is absolutely replicable for people in totally different contexts. It's just, you know, build that community, identify people who are passionate about that subject. And I think I was really the target reader, if you like. So I knew what kind of event I would like to go to and what I would like to read.
Right. 100%.
And I think, you know, all of your listeners, like, they will have their pet subject. So, and I think my other advice would be, you know, you're going to invest so much time and effort in your startup. So it has to really be something you personally believe in. And I think if you are the target client, then you know what your customers want, because 100%. You are a customer.
And some days are, actually a lot of days are really hard and draining. It's going to be like 2 a.m. You're going to want to go to sleep and not send one more email. But because you love your company and you believe in it so much, there's some secret adrenaline sauce in that spirit that helps you send that one last email and stay up 2 more hours or whatever it is. And I definitely don't promote living an unhealthy life or like not being, you know, mindful about how you spend your time. But it is really important to give life your all.
No,
it's really important to give life your all.
I totally agree. And I also always took the view, like, I think way more of the really successful entrepreneurs like Richard Branson have actually had tons of failures. And I think people, like you said, they see us on stage or see us profiled by a newspaper, but they don't realize for us to get to that point, people have had years of like absolute disasters or things that have gone wrong. And, you know, you need to kind of have the disasters to work out what you're good at and actually what your company should be doing.
Yeah.
And if you don't have the failures, you're not going to be a success. So I think there's nothing to worry about that. But people kind of, because they don't want to talk about it publicly, they don't realize that we all have the same problems, whether you're super famous like Zuckerberg or, you know, one of us.
100%. So tell me a little bit about where you are today.
So I sold my company in October after 5 years. And it's been a massive transition to go back into like the real world, in inverted commas, because, you know, when you run a startup, I had no boss, I had no working hours, I had no set vacation. And actually, I now work in the UK Parliament. So very different. I have just shifted from being an entrepreneur to working with the government. And I've just spent the summer in Africa running startup competitions, which has been riveting. So imagine being in Tanzania in East Africa, in the capital, Dar es Salaam, and you're told that you're going to have 50 students who all want to launch a startup. And I'm used to running programs in London where everyone comes with their MacBook and they're all sitting taking notes and they tweet at you afterwards. And I turn up in Tanzania and they sign in on the sheet and nobody has an email address. So they want to launch a company, they want to launch a startup, but they don't even have access to the internet. So that for me was like absolute game changer. Like, you know, how can we help support startups in developing countries? And that's the one of the main projects I'm working on at the moment.
I mean, you could see why I'm so in love with her, right? You're amazing. How can people connect with you?
Well, I think the best thing I would say, I get hundreds of emails, is actually just to tweet at me, just like at Theodora Clark, and I will personally read it and I will personally reply.
Can you spell it for us just in case?
Yeah, so it's TheodoraClarke.
Perfect. Thank you so much for predominantly for being my friend. That. And True. For being on the Women in Tech podcast.
You're very welcome.
Mostly for being my friend, though. No, honestly, you guys, it's really important. The Women in Tech, whatever you call it, project, community service, whatever you want to call it, the reason I do it is for collaboration, connectivity, conversation. And this is the same thing. When I met Theodora at Astia, it was about finding someone like-minded that I could be vulnerable with and so that we could accelerate together. And that's exactly why I produce the show. It's exactly why I put any energy behind any women in tech related anything that I do. And it's important that all of you find one another too. And so I hope that you'll take your time and you'll tweet at Theodora as well as all the other wonderful people that we interview. And I will talk to you guys, see you guys, hear you guys in the next episode. Remember to check out the Women in Tech Facebook group at womenintechvip.com. It forwards right to the Facebook group so you don't get lost. That's womenintechvip.com. Or you can tweet at me at Esprit Devora at Women in Tech Show. Theodora, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Bye.
Women in Tech is an independently funded project funded by you, the community. So the way that you could support us is by going to patreon.com/womenintech and making a small contribution. Every little bit counts. That's Patreon, patreon.com/womenintech. Thank you so much for believing in our vision. Our incredible partner, Hack Reactor, helping people become legitimate engineers, is offering an outstanding scholarship program. If you don't take advantage of this, that's just nuts. Go to hackreactor.com/scholarships and enter Women in Tech. That's hackreactor.com/scholarships and enter the code Women in Tech.